Welcome to Handsome Boys Comics Hour. Hope you survive the experience.
Those boys are so handsome!
One writer.
One artist.
One weekly discussion of comics and nerd culture. I'm your host, Robbie Dorman, literature geek and writer.
And I'm your other host, Eric Z. Goodnight, professional artist and illustration nerd.
And we are the Handsome Boys Comics Hour, your home for news, reviews, slightly antagonistic banter, and much, much more. This is episode 31, brought to you by Monster Ultra Red Energy Drink. There are no casualties officially, conclusively proven by any kind of doctor that this has caused. So
maybe drink. Some mutations, though.
So drink it up. Monster Ultra Red.
You'll grow an extra arm.
But you won't fall asleep in the road.
Well, that's fine. You can,
and then you can use your extra arm to
drive.
To drive.
If you're driving stick, even better.
Stick?
A manual transmission, driving stick.
I know.
Have you? Do you live on this planet, right?
I'm being purposefully obtuse.
Well, that's how I would describe you. We're going to put that on your tombstone. Purposely obtuse.
That's not bad, actually. I don't necessarily disagree. You know, if that was the case.
What the hell does that even mean?
Purposefully obtuse. I like it.
Yeah, that's good.
That's good. I like that.
Well, it's time for a new tattoo, Robbie.
I'm going to get it in, like, right across my belly.
No, you should get a tramp stamp. It says
tramp stamp.
Purposefully obtuse.
Does it have to be in tribal lettering?
Probably. Tribal lettering with barbs and butterflies. You should just really kind of...
I already have a butterfly. I don't need any more.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it really pretty?
Is
it upside down on your wrist so you can look at it?
No, it's from a Cuban propaganda poster.
Okay.
Actually, about a...
So you're not shitting me.
I seriously... It's on my back. It's like, okay. It has nails through it. It looks like it's nailed to my back. Like, you know, people pin butterflies like bug collectors.
Yes.
I'll show you. I have one.
Like entomology?
Yeah. It's I like it. It's really cool.
Do you like entomology?
No, not really. Okay. Actually, it's kind of the people that do that are kind of creepy. But
they have crossed eyes like the dude in Silence of the Lambs.
I don't even remember that. I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
I'd be remembering stuff.
I don't even like that movie that much. I mean,
what? That movie's great. That movie's great.
It just doesn't do it for me.
All the terrible shit movies that you watch.
I know. It's not a bad movie by any means. I just don't like it nearly as much as most people do. It's just the way it is, I guess. I don't know.
Well, now that we know that you're wrong.
So, folks, we got a great episode waiting for you. Science of the Lambs aside. First of all, I'd like to do a little housekeeping. Remind everyone, Hawkeye Contest is still going on. Run until Christmas Eve.
Did you announce it last time?
I did. I'm going to keep talking about it.
I guess I just slept through it or something. I don't know what's going on.
But Christmas Eve is still running. Tell everyone you know. Spread the word. Share with all your friends. Every day, you can tweet about it every day and get another entry. Mm-hmm. Every day. That's like a million days in between now and Christmas Eve. That's like a million additional entries you can get. And then you can almost guarantee yourself one of the best books of the year.
The Hawk Guy. Hawk Guy.
Yeah, like I said, Hawk Guy.
Hawk Guy.
Now we're just Now we're just going to go into Hawk, aren't we?
Yeah, we're just going to devolve into Hawk. That's how it goes.
Hawk. But we have Sandman Volume 5 and 6 this week. We've got weekly floppies. But first, we're going to check in.
Ooh.
Eric, what do you got for me?
My life is fantastic. That's what I'm checking in with. I've joined a cult.
I was going to say, which one?
I actually had friends who literally said that exact sentence to me. So, yeah, we've joined a cult.
Well, at least, I mean, they're honest with themselves, I guess.
I don't know what it was. They were, like, into that David Icke Illuminati conspiracy theory shit. And they're like, yeah, we joined a cult.
There's a subreddit called Conspiratard.
Nice.
That I follow. Brings me a little bit of joy every day.
That sounds like a good follow, I think.
Yeah, it's nice.
I was just going to check in with two games, one that I played and one that I have not played yet. The first game is Fez. I believe you're aware of it. Do you have a copy?
I have a copy. I played some of it.
I started watching the film Indie Game. Indie Game the movie, I think is what it's called.
Yeah.
You recommended it to me, although I think my brother did also.
Yeah.
Really excellent. Couldn't finish it because I didn't have a whole heck of a lot of time this morning. But I watched about 40 minutes of it, and I had played the other games featured in the movie, which are Braid and Super Meat Boy.
Yes.
I owned copies of both of them, but the Fez I did not own, and I really liked the creator. I liked his sort of outlook on things, and I liked seeing his process. I haven't finished it.
A lot of people don't not like him.
Oh, I am sure they don't.
Phil Fish, he's
a lot of people don't like a lot of things. People get on the internet to make their hate grow. It's a cesspool of negativity.
He's kind of quit the internet because of that.
And I don't blame the guy. He's made a really great game. It's a nice piece of art, and I'm enjoying playing it.
Does it like make you dizzy at all?
No.
Okay.
I can't
play for more than a couple hours, and then I start getting like sick.
Interesting. I haven't had that problem. I used to get motion sick playing Half-Life 2, but that was 9 years ago.
Yeah. How would you describe Fez?
Fez is a game that I think that's my favorite thing about it is the way that the game is built. And that it is built polygonally, you know, things exist in a three-dimensional world, but you experience them in a two-dimensional fashion.
Right.
You know, like you move in on an X and Y axis only, and then you can rotate the whole world, and the map changes, or the way you interact with it changes. It's a lot like Paper Mario.
Yes, except it's... I think Paper Mario only, you can only flip it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's only the flipping
one way.
Right.
You know, this is once, then you flip it back. This is all the way. You can do complete 360 degree rotation.
Yeah, this is like Paper Mario meets Portal.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of got the Mario 64 collecting stars. Mechanic going for it, and that you're running around collecting these cubes to rebuild the universe. It's wild, and it's really well put together in that it's got this really glorious looking pixel art.
Yeah, that's why I figured you'd like it, just because of that alone.
No, it's a very, very nicely made game. I really like the thinking in it, and It's very slick, very smart. I'm happy to have got it, although I wish I'd got it on sale. But it's, you know, it's fine. Got it for a cool $10.
Yeah, did you catch that? And he had this game almost done.
Mm-hmm.
And then he redid, like, all the art in it.
Yeah, well, it's not that he had it almost done, but he did redo the art multiple times. Because I got that far to where he said that, and he showed some old tiles compared to his new tiles, and I don't think I would enjoy this game anywhere near as much, because I think that's a big part of it, it's a big part of indie games in general, is having a unique visual style. because that's something that you don't really get in a blockbuster, you know, AAA title. They're going to go out full out realistic, and they're not going to spend a lot of time trying to make unique visuals.
Yeah, that's true. All the multi-million dollar games are, that's what they do look like. I mean, all very similar. It's become like a meme. Like they're different shades of brown.
Yes. Although, you know, they are going to spend tons of time and money and just throw artists at making things look gorgeous, but there might be like two artists on an indie game, you know, right. So it's a lot more direct communication.
Yeah.
The other game that I bought because it was on sale, and I had bought the soundtrack a couple weeks back after finding it just randomly on Reddit. Someone was asking about music to work out to, and he's like, here, this is a chiptune a game soundtrack called Tiny Barbarian. And I thought it was just like a weird concept album, but as it turns out, Tiny Barbarian actually has a game on Steam, and I bought it for $5 and haven't been able to play it yet.
What kind of game is it?
It's a side-scrolling game. It's like a very advanced NES game is what it looks like.
Okay.
The character is so small that he does, like, his head is like 4 pixels, you know? Mm. But it looks pretty neat. Can't really vouch for it. Haven't been able to play it because I've been wearing Borderlands out.
Borderlands 2 is a great game. So.
It's pretty amazing. So I've been doing a lot of Borderlands co-op and have managed to squeak in some Fez. Not that I need to talk about more things, but I also finished Cryptonomicon. Finally.
So what's your final consensus on it?
I really enjoyed it, but I still think Anthem has had the most satisfying ending. The whole, like, last couple of hours of Cryptonomicon, it felt like it had already ended, and he was just winding stuff up. I sort of feel like he could have ended it a lot earlier than he did, but there was still some good stuff that happened. But Cryptonomicon is a book that I really loved it, but I don't know who I would recommend it to. I think Neal Stephenson is kind of an acquired taste.
I think I'll check. I enjoyed Snow Crash.
Yeah.
I'll check out Anthem. If you said that's the
Anthem is like the most. Yeah, Anthem is honestly one of my favorite sci-fi books of all time. It's so good.
I'll read it this week, and we can talk about it next week.
That sounds good. I'm really interested to see what you think of it. Cryptonomicon was excellent. So what'd you get into?
Well, I have two things. One is your favorite thing in the entire world.
What could that be?
It's a board game.
I was going to say, does it start with board? Because I'm bored already.
I think you've made that joke before.
I probably have. It's funny every time.
But it's a board game. It's pretty new. It's called Eldritch Horror.
Mm-hmm.
It is by Fantasy Flight Games. Fantasy Flight Games makes a ton of these games in this H.P. Lovecraft
world.
It's the same people make Arkham Horror and Mansions of Madness and Elder Signs, and there's probably another one I'm forgetting.
I want to know when they're going to make a board game about racism.
There's a game that came out very recently about the Underground Railroad where you are trying to save slaves.
That's pretty rad, actually, but that was an H.P. Lovecraft joke.
I understand, but our buddy Nick he was talking about it. I'm like, I don't know if I really want to play a game where you're like saving slaves and you have to decide who lives and who dies and stuff.
Schindler's List, the game.
I know, it's a little heavy. But Eldritch Horror is set in the same universe as all these other games. You know, it's Cthulhu and other ancient ones, ancient gods that are coming back and you have to fight them and the, you know, various monsters. This game is similar, but I would say a better game than Arkham Horror. Arkham and this game are both co-op games, meaning everyone playing is on the same team and is trying to defeat an ancient one who is basically controlled by AI, you know, decided in the rules. You know, each phase, there's different phases in the game, and then for one certain phase is basically it tells the how the Ancient One and all its minions act. Arkham has the same kind of setup, but it's a lot more complicated. There's a lot more rules in Arkham. There's a lot more upkeep and moving shit around, and it takes half the time just knowing what's happening. This game is a lot simpler and has a lot more storytelling in it. There's a lot more, like, you know, role-playing, and, like, the cards are more interesting. When you're going into an encounter, you get more choices. You can level up your characters, you know, in the game. Even if a character dies or goes insane, it happened in the last game I played, my character was a sailor. You end up going crazy. What happens is I abandon him, and I get a new character. A spy character. She happened to spawn very, very close to where he went crazy. And then in my next encounter, I moved her to him and basically encounter
his gibbering corpse.
Yeah, like him just going crazy, and I encountered that as my first encounter as my new character. So that was So I would say if you're a fan of Arkham Horror, I would say definitely try this out. I liked it a lot more. It's a long game. Our game took, we had four players, it took 4 hours. Some people don't even consider, like, they think long is 6 hours, mm-hmm. but I would say 4 hour game is long enough.
4 hour game is pretty long.
But it moved quickly. You don't ever feel like you're bored or you're waiting around. Everything is moving fast. But Eldritch Horror, Fantasy Flight games. Fantasy Flight always has nice games, beautiful art, nice pieces, all that stuff, and this game is the same. Looks very nice, works very well. Relatively simple and excellent.
Nice.
Other thing I'm checking in with is Preacher comic book series. Eric already had saw that I was talking about this and wondering why I'm reading a comic book that we're not, you know, assigned from podcast.
Don't you know comic books are for nerds?
Yeah, I know. But it's one of those, you know, everyone says, why haven't you read, you of all people, why haven't you read Preacher?
It really is. It does blow my mind that you are reading Sandman and The Preacher for the first time.
They're two big blind spots in my.
Yeah, those. You know, that's my, that. Those were the things. Those were Preacher also, in addition to Sandman, or were what legitimized comics for me when I was, you know, in my early 20s.
Yeah, I never had read them, so I'm working. I'm about halfway through Preacher now. I'm really enjoying it.
Where are you at? Are you just before Ancient History? I think Ancient History is number 5.
Let me see. I'm just trying to think. It's about Preacher. He's about to go and get, go do a voodoo ceremony.
So that's
to talk to Genesis.
Yes, that's Southern Fried, I think, is that one. He goes to Louisiana.
Yeah, exactly. That's I'm like in the middle of that Parker.
That one's pretty good. My favorite one is I think it's Salvation. Salvation's a really great book.
Is that later or earlier than that?
I don't know the titles. I want to say Salvation is later. There's no way that I can describe the one I'm thinking of without completely spoiling the reveal.
Okay. Yeah, the one I've enjoyed so far is the one where his family is, you know, kidnapped him, and he, you know, the Duke come back and talks to him and gives him a pep talk, mm-hmm. and stuff. That's probably my favorite so far. Where he like officially becomes grows into his badass self.
Yep.
But I'm really enjoying Preacher.
It's good. It's intense.
Yeah, it's really good. I still think, so far, I mean, I'm really enjoying Preacher. I don't know, maybe it's just because I like the Punisher a lot. I'm still thinking Garth Ennis' Punisher Maximum, I think, is better.
I think Garth Ennis was kind of made to write the Punisher.
Yeah, exactly. But, and especially in this book where he's no ties to the Marvel Universe at all. It's just, you know, aside from there's Nick Fury, but other than that, there's no one else. Like, there's no Spider-Man or any other heroes, so it works very well.
Well, the Preachers, it's a classic, though. It's
beautiful. Very good. I haven't finished it yet, so I may even grow into it more. Of course, everyone said, like, from what a lot of people say, his Hitman book from DC is the best stuff he's ever written.
That's amazing.
But I need to read it.
Hmm.
But that is all I have for checking in. Now that we're done with checking in, we're going to go into weekly floppies. And before we start, I want to say that we've been mentioning, like, trying to cover what Spawn's up to nowadays. Because, I mean, Spawn still gets a new book every month. Mm-hmm. Still, Todd McFarlane still writes them. But I had put it on a list for this week, and then I found out that it is not available digitally, as far as I can tell. Couldn't get it on Comixology, couldn't get it on Image's website. So, Todd McFarlane, come on, get with the times.
Yep.
We want to read Spawn.
He's too busy buying baseballs.
Well, that's and carrying them around in cardboard boxes. Mm-hmm. $1 million baseballs.
Yep. I mean, what does he care?
I guess not. He's just like, meh.
I don't care about nothing.
Is that how he talks?
He talks like a horrible whatever, but I can't do his voice. I can't do that kind of accent, whatever you call it. I certainly can't do it.
So, speaking of Garth Ennis, we have a new book from him as our first book of the week.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I saw this. I was like, man, if I was into a Spawn, we'd do this. And like, oh, no Spawn? I guess we're going to do the three dogs at the end of the world story.
Yep.
It's called Rover Red Charlie. It's number one. Just came out. Created, written by Garth Ennis. Art by Michael D. Pascal. And letters by Kurt Hathaway. And what I just said is basically the story. It's like, mm-hmm. humanity is going crazy. And it's basically telling the story of these three dogs who are buddies trying to survive. And it's charming for how there's horrible things in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I really enjoy these three dogs and their little adventure so far. It's kind of almost cheating having animals, like cute dogs, as your protagonists.
Yes.
Because you're like, oh, I don't want them to die. You start rooting for them automatically just because they're cute.
If this was a story about cats, it'd be all over. Although you hated the cat story last time.
I did, but the cat story wouldn't work like this because three cats would never team up.
That's right. It would. All the people would start killing themselves, and then the cats would start doing it too. They're like, whatever.
The cats would probably just eat. I don't know. I don't even know how you couldn't tell this story with cats, but it works very well with dogs. There's three dogs. There's one who's like a helper dog. Literally, he's like a assistant. You know, like a blind. Mm-hmm. Blind walker dog. What's the service dog, I guess you want to call him?
Service dog works. I think seeing dog. Eye dog is what you're looking for.
Seeing eye dog, service dog. And then there's a German shepherd who's kind of a prick. And then there's two he's kind of a side character, really. Then there's the two other dogs. Is it a beagle or a corgi? No, it's a basset hound.
It's like a kind of
basset hound, and then like a. What would you call the red dog?
It's like a lab or something.
Irish setter, maybe? But they are... The world is going, like, exploding. Basically, humanity has contracted virus contagion that makes them go suicidal or homicidal. And these dogs are trying to figure out what the hell is happening.
My favorite thing about this...
Yeah.
Is how when they bark, they just say, I'm a dog, I'm a dog, I'm a dog, I'm a dog.
Yes, I really do like that.
Because if dogs could talk, that's what they'd be saying.
Hey, I'm a dog, I'm a dog, I'm a dog. That scene at the end with that cop who's like saves one of them, like throws him across that chasm. Mm-hmm. That's a great little beat. There's this one guy that's managed to like, you think he's crying, so I think he's probably fighting the sickness or whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he's got it, but he's clearly still, you know, sane.
Yeah.
And then he's attacked by 1,000 children.
Yeah, I know, an army of little children. What do you think about the art? You like it? I like it.
It's interesting. I think that there's something a little crude and a little naive about it. But I think it's just sort of the digital nature of it, and that it's like trying to look like real media, and it just looks a little smeary and anti-aliasy to me. But I don't think it's anything that would bother anyone but someone that does digital art for a living. It's good. It tells the story. And they look like dogs.
Yeah, I know. Like, the dogs look like dogs, and their, like, expressions are, like, genuine. Yes. They look like faces a dog would make.
Mm-hmm. No, it's certainly very good. I think that it was a good choice for this book, but it's not really my favorite. It doesn't get me excited.
You know, it kind of reminds me of We Three a little,
mm-hmm.
just because it's animals on, like, an adventure, but aside from that, it's not similar to it, but certainly doesn't look as nice as Frank Quitely, but...
Yeah, this guy's no Frank Quitely. I am, did you call out who did the artwork?
D. Pascal. Yeah. I forget his first name.
He did. Everything. I could tell just by looking at it that it was done pretty much entirely by one person. I don't know. It's good. It's very competent, but it's not the kind of thing that really blows you away.
No, but it works, and I'm glad we ended up reading this because I like it a lot.
I think so.
I'm a buy.
I wonder what that means, Rover Red Charlie. If that's like radio code RRC.
Yeah.
I wonder what that means.
I think those are just the names of the dogs.
Is it really?
Well, Rover, there's a red dog. I assume he's red. You never learn. Yeah, the one calls him Red.
Hmm.
So I guess that's Red. I'm guessing those are the names of the dogs, but it probably does have some kind of, aside from that, I assume it has some kind of, it's supposed to be like a military or radio illusion.
I'm a dog. I'm a dog. I'm a dog.
I'm a dog. I'm a dog. I'm a dog.
That's what my dog would always say.
I'm a dog. I'm a dog. I'm a dog. So we're gonna. Okay, so that's Rover Red Charlie number one. You're a buy, Eric?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. This is a good book. It's a good buy.
Yeah. It's pretty solid. I'm excited to see where it happens with it. We're going over DC. Our first DC book is Batman Superman number 6. Written by Greg Pak with pencils Brett Booth, inks by Norm Ratman. I mean, where the hell is the credits page? There it is. With colors by Andrew Dollhouse and Rob Lay doing the letters. And in this, it's like superheroes taken over as, like, video game characters?
Yeah, it's kind of nonsensical.
Yeah, like, you have Jimmy Olsen. They've taken over... They were playing as Batman, quote-unquote, in the real world, fighting Mongol.
Yes.
I'm not sure if this is the first time... This may be the first time Mongol's appeared in the 52, I'm not sure. But... And then Superman has to come save him because Batman's, quote-unquote, dead. Because he can't fight Mongol. Because Batman's like a dude and Mongol's like a super powerful alien overlord. But I don't like this book.
I don't hate it, but I think that it's something that whenever you cover any kind of technology like this, video games or any sort of pop culture reference, man, you really got to crush it or it is hokey as fuck. And I think that this is really teetering on the hokey as fuck side.
Yeah, when it's revealed, okay, this is minor spoiler, revealed at the last page, like, this is, that Mongol is behind all of this, mm-hmm. that he's like, oh, we're gonna have everyone tied into this network, and they're gonna all be players.
Yeah.
And the end of this is Batman fighting Superman. Honestly, that is true, because if there's, like, millions of people... And they're on. Well, that's the movie coming out. Everyone's like, "Oh, it's Batman and Superman. I hope they fight."
Mm-hmm.
It kind of defeats the whole purpose of what. Like that made me like almost redeem it a little bit because I understood that's the message it's sending. Like how stupid that is. Mm-hmm. But still, this plot seems like it could have been like written in like 1994.
Well, they wouldn't have said the term MMO, I don't think, in 1994. No,
they
wouldn't,
but it's the same thing, like, there was a whole, it's like, back when, like, in the X-Men cartoon, when, like, Mojo captured the X-Men and made them fight each other for, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same premise.
Yeah, I think so.
In the arcade in the 70s or 80s with Chris Claremont and X-Men. And I mean, it's been done.
But
like the
did they crowdsource the villainy? Because that's what's going on. Isn't that really deep?
No.
It's like the Wikipedia of evil.
You're making me like it less.
Good!
I mean, I generally like Greg Pak. He generally does pretty good work. I mean, he did, he's been writing this. He's been writing our next book, the Action Comics, he wrote, which I, spoiler alert, I enjoy, but this is, I don't like it. I mean, the art's nice, I guess, enough. It looks, you know, it does a job.
It looks like Jim Lee drew it.
Yeah, it looks sort of like Jim Lee drew it. That's the DC house style at this point, but it doesn't look, it's not bad.
Why is this whole book in landscape?
I don't know. That's another question I had. I don't know why it's...
Isn't it weird?
It is strange. I was like, why is it like this? Is this... I guess it's laid out like this in the comic.
The artist just had a shitload of really big paper.
I guess he was like, well, I don't have anything... And I can't draw on anything else, so...
Yep. I have to use this paper to get a grant.
But... It is hokey. Like you said, hokey as mm-hmm. fuck. That's a good way to say it.
That's the best way to say it, because it's got fuck in it.
And Batman's not dead? Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, like I really thought that was going to be the death of Batman right there.
Oh, Batman's dead for the millionth time for not really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they're going to kill Batman in his team-up book with Superman in the sixth issue. Right in the middle of a zero-year tie-in. Like, yep. Zero-year is happening. I'm sure they'd kill him right in the middle of that. It makes perfect sense.
Yep, I'm sure everyone reading it was like,
yeah.
I think it's just like everything... I don't know, it's really clumsy. I didn't really think about it, like, the way that you just did, but who, for even a split second, was going to be like, okay, I guess Batman's dead now?
No one.
Zero people.
No.
And I mean, and when I read it, I was like, okay, I'm sure he's not dead.
Yeah.
Like, that's immediately the first thing I thought, but I didn't even think about it the way you just said, that no one ever is going to buy that. So why even fucking do it?
Yeah, there's no reason to. Unless you can make the reveal of why he's not dead interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not interesting.
No.
Not at all. I don't... So. I don't know. This is do not buy for me.
Yeah, do not buy.
Double don't buy.
Double don't buy.
Next up in DC is Action Comics number 26. This is also written by Greg Pak, with art by Aaron Cooter, colors by June Chung, letters by DC Lettering. So I guess in-house letters did this. This is kind of seeing like Superman fight like a kaiju, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
I mean, it's a giant monster. They were just called giant monsters before we got the word kaiju.
I know, but kaiju's has like some pizzazz to it.
Some zazz?
It has some pizzazz.
Some zazz?
Not zazz. He's a serial killer.
Stop saying zazz.
I'm saying pizzazz. I hate you.
You don't even know what I'm doing. Oh,
but, yeah,
You never saw that Metalocalypse. Stop saying Zazz.
If I did, I've forgotten it.
I actually think that it was the Rock and Roll Clown episode.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the only thing I remember from that is
you're too busy whispering "I do cocaine" in my ear.
I do cocaine.
Now, like in my literal ear, and like your mustache tickles the hair in my ears.
Well, that's the answer to that question. Only slightly.
Yes.
But I like this one. It's written by the same guy who just wrote the Batman Superman. And this I like a million times more. It's like an interesting little adventure with Superman trying to like fight this monster, but then he gets like this government agent who also has powers that are interesting in a certain way. He can make himself intangible, but Superman has to deal with this kind of monster who's not necessarily evil.
Yeah.
He's kind of force of nature.
I think that DC needs to really take a long, hard look at books like this. This is really more a model that they should be following. Yeah. You know, it's got a good mix of action and humor, and some. It's actually got moments in it that make you think and feel things.
Yeah,
as like opposed to just, I'm a badass, and now it's dark, and now I'm gonna fight a bunch of guys.
Exactly.
What was that? What was that Damian Batman book that we read?
Damian, Son of Batman.
Good God.
Yeah.
I still have nightmares.
Issue 2 came out. There's a reason we didn't read it.
Because it's shitty as the first book.
I saw a couple pages from it. He breaks Bruce Wayne's neck.
Who does?
Damian.
What the fuck for?
Accidentally.
Who the fuck's writing this book? Frank Miller?
No.
Does he paint him yellow? Does he paint him yellow?
He's not painting anyone yellow.
Does anyone get an emergency tracheotomy?
Not yet.
Okay.
They'll probably work one in because it's that fucking contrived.
Are there any racial slurs?
I only saw like 3 pages of it. I don't know.
So there was only like 2.
Maybe 1.
Okay.
It's not Frank Miller.
Okay.
But yeah, this book doesn't look like Jim Lee drew it, which is a plus in my book.
Yeah.
It looks nice. I like it.
Oh, wait, we're talking about this comic again. Yes.
Yes, this, not Damien.
It doesn't look like Jim Lee drew it.
No, it doesn't.
But it looks like a good, competent artist drew it.
Yes.
I like a lot of the pages in this. I don't know that I like particularly every single drawing in the book. I mean, there are no real weak points, but I think the monster looks really great. I like the facial expressions on Lana.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really cool scenes in this book. It's a good little read.
Yeah, it was, and it's a nice little one-shot story, self-contained.
Mm-hmm. Well, it says to be continued at the end.
Does it? Oh, no. Probably with the more encounters with that agent.
Well, there's a cliffhanger at the end. The monster turns into a little naked baby nightcrawler.
I know. I just don't know what that means.
He's got hair like Blanca.
Uh-oh. Maybe it's Blanca.
It's totally Blanca. He looks Brazilian.
He must like soccer.
He's fucking bananas for it.
So that's the next issue of Action Comics. We'll see. Superman coach the mini Blanca's soccer team.
Let us hope that's what happens.
That'd be a good story, I think. Greg Pak, don't try and steal that from us. It's exclusive to Handsome Boys Comics Hour.
Mm-hmm.
It's all trademarks and licenses and all that nonsense.
Don't you know it?
Don't you know? So that's it. That's Action Comics Story 26. I'm a buy.
I am a buy as well.
So double buy.
Double buy.
Go over to Marvel, and we're going to read Inhumanity number 1. This is springing straight out of Infinity, with Matt Fraction as the writer, Oliver Coipel as the pencils. Inks are Mark Morales, and colors are Laura Martin, with ancient flashback art. Like they call it after the ancient flashback. Lineal Yu... Or I was supposed to Infinity Flashback, which is last week. Lineal Yu, Lineal Francis Yu? Just Lineal Yu?
It's a different guy, probably.
Of course. Jerry Langlin and Israel Silva with Infinity Flashback art, Dustin Weaver and Israel Silva. This is right after, Infinity saw Atalon explode, spread the Terra Genesis mist... virus, whatever you want to call it, throughout the Earth. And this book kind of details how we saw Inhumans start springing up everywhere. This one focuses a lot on Karnak, who's always been a favorite of mine. And this book's like a little sad. I was sad after I finished it. I don't want to give it away, the spoiler, but...
It's kind of tough to talk about it. And
yeah, you see, this little spoiler alert, you haven't read it yet, You see, Karnak's power is basically he can find the weaknesses in things. And so the Avengers find him and capture him, and he figures out something. We are not told what it is. It has to be something. It would have to be something earth-shattering, because he kills himself. He considers himself a failure for not figuring out some earth-shattering thing about the Inhumans and the Inhuman royal family. And that's pretty big, because Karnak's an old character. He's been around for 50, 60 years. Since early Fantastic Four, when they first encountered the Inhumans. But art is gorgeous.
Hmm. It changes so much, it's just weird.
Yeah, well, at least they give you, like, a reason for it. Like, it's flashbacks and stuff. I know that they were trying to get this out in time. Right after Infinity finished. But I mean, the art changes, but I like all the artists individually. So, if you can get your head around the shifting styles,
I think they look good. For the most part, the colorist does a really good job of tying everything together. I think where it's most noticeable is the Lanil Yu part.
Yeah.
Where it's just such a hard shift, but they're trying to draw your attention to that. They even, like, on that page where it's transitioning back to modern day, there's a shift in the background from white and cool colors to warm colors. I think is, you know, the way that this book is cast more. Which I think it's pretty interesting. It's an interesting concept.
That, I mean, I love the Inhumans.
Yeah, I wasn't surprised when I saw this week.
Yeah, I mean, this is an isolated event in humanity, whatever you want to call it. It's going to launch after this. It's going to go into a on-running book just called Inhuman.
Okay.
Also written by Matt Fraction. But this issue is basically mostly about Karnak. And background on the Inhumans, and the next issue is going to be Medusa, and then they move on to other Inhumans, I believe, as we go the royal family.
I thought this was pretty fascinating. Are we going to follow this story?
If we can, from week to week, we'll see how. I'm going to try and make it so that we can read each one. I mean, I love the Inhumans, so yes, we will probably. So, but I really enjoyed it. I like it a lot. If you like the Inhumans, you wonder what's happening after Infinity with them, definitely pick this up. It's really well written. Fraction, I mean, you don't even have to. I mean, he's become one of the most famous comic writers around now, but he does a very good job with this one. He's most well known for Hawkeye now, which is kind of a lighter book.
It's interesting because I kept thinking about Hawkeye when I was reading this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say it's, like, easy in comparison to this, but it's certainly a lot lighter reading, and it's a lot of just, you know, funny dialogue, and it's a very different book compared to this, which is, I mean, it's certainly a lot driven by dialogue, but it's, I don't know, it's such a different kind of story that it's kind of hard for me to sort of see what his style is, you know?
Yeah.
And we've read plenty of it, plenty of his work, but it's, I don't know, it's odd. It's very, very, he's very versatile as a storyteller. This is very different than Hawkeye.
Yeah, we should, once we're done with Sandman, or, you know, eventually we should read his run on Immortal Iron Fist. Because that's a different tone than this.
It sounds really fun. That's a character that I'm pretty interested in.
What adds a lot of it didn't sell amazingly, so it got canceled, unfortunately, I think way too early, because I think he could have done something like he's doing with Hawkeye.
Yeah,
he could have done something.
I think that's another character you could easily do a story like My Life is a Weapon, or, you know, it's, I don't know, he's a talented guy, and I think that he seems more difficult to pigeonhole. You know, he's not like a Garth Ennis that's like can be summed up by, oh, it's a book about awful shit happening. depraved people doing awful shit. You can't really boil it down to something, a simple statement like that.
No. So that's inhumanity number one. Eric, bye?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I'm a bye as well. It's very good. Very solid.
Double bye.
Lastly this week, our first time reading this book. We've ended the embargo just because Venom's in it. I wanted Eric to... I was going to read it anyway, because it came out very quickly. I was like... I just read 22 last week, and now 23 is already out.
They're not fucking around. That's amazing.
That's very fast turnover. I mean, they have...
Neil Gaiman, you should pay attention.
Yes. But we have Superior Spider-Man number 23, written by Dan Slott and Christos Gage, pencils by Humberto Ramos, with inks by Victor Alazaba, color by Edgar Delgado, letters by Chris Eliopoulos. I did it all right that time. Yeah. This is seeing Doc Ock Spidey encountering Venom for the first time since he's taken over Peter's body. Flash Thompson has kind of quickly ascertained that this is not Peter Parker in there. Or if it is, it's not the Peter Parker he knows. And we're kind of starting to see things unravel for Doc Ock a little bit. You know, at least behind the scenes, people are going like, there are multiple people like closing in on, they think they something's wrong. This is not Peter Parker, etc., etc. But there's also a huge like character thing for Flash Thompson at the end, which is what that's why I picked up this book, because I was following Venom. We were following Venom. And it's really interesting this happens to him. I really hope that he doesn't just disappear after this, though.
I know. I think if they're going to take Venom in a different direction, it's going to be really disappointing, because Flash Thompson Venom, that was an excellent book. It'd be very disappointing.
Yeah, this is another spoiler. Like, they give him his legs back.
Yes.
But also, at the same time, take the symbiote off of him. But then who bonds immediately with Superior Spider-Man? Mm-hmm. Which, that's really interesting. I want to know, this has got me interested in Spider-Man again. Because I want to know what happens when this Venom symbiote ties itself to the new Peter Parker. Will it know that it's not actually Peter Parker? That it's Doc Ock in there? But, again, reading this book, at the same time as, like, I'm interested because it's Venom and we're following Venom, it's just so contrived, this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of bullshit in this that just makes so little sense. The book is not poorly done. That's what I always kept thinking when we had talked about this. It's certainly not poorly done, but there's just so much just very strange decisions in these stories. What were you about to call out?
I was just going to say, I knew about this stuff before just by reading an issue here or there, catching one. It's obvious that this is not Peter Parker. This is the Marvel Universe. People get mind-controlled and possessed by demons, and, people get their bodies taken over by other factors. It's not all the time, but occasionally. It's very clear. Aunt May wouldn't know that that's not the Peter that she's known for his whole life?
Mm-hmm.
That she wouldn't know that? And they all play around. Everyone's like, oh, well, the Avengers notice, and Wolverine notices the changes, that they just think it's someone. But really? It's very clear that it's not him. How much do I have to suspend my disbelief to, like, go along with a story?
You know what I was reading this? As I'm thinking, the Spider-Man reader must be a very different audience than a lot of these other books. It doesn't, like, particularly... How many of these books has Humberto Ramos drawn?
I don't know. I know he's one of their rotators. Mm-hmm. Because this book comes out so much.
Yeah.
I mean, it's bi-monthly, so two... Or bi-weekly, I would say. So twice a month. So he's in a rotation with a few other artists. So maybe,
but he's a regular artist.
He draws fast
on this.
Yeah, on this book,
it feels like a smart book for kids, like maybe for sophisticated teenagers. Like, I feel like a lot of the weird ass decisions are done for a young audience that isn't going to really care too much about keeping a Peter Parker Spider-Man or, you know, any sort of guy. How does that resonate with you?
I don't. It does seem, you know, there's things are more a little more clearly spelled out. Then there's not as much allusion to like plot points. And a lot of that can be hidden just because of the way Doc Ock talks.
Yes.
He is that play up that villain aspect where they monologue a lot.
Yes.
And clearly announce their intentions on things and stuff like that.
Yes.
But it still feels a little too on the nose for me. Aside from all the fact that he's not hiding that he's a different person at all in a very short span of time. You don't think they'd get a psychic in there?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think that this is actually pretty well written, but for a less sophisticated reader.
Yeah.
This is.
Well, that's the thing. Like, Dan Slott, who writes this, he is a huge Spider-Man, like, a fan, and he has, he could name any kind of history in the character.
Yeah.
He could probably spell it out backwards and forwards. And again, he doesn't do a bad job, but
no, I think that for what it is, it's very well done. I just don't like it.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that there's all kinds of incredibly weird things going on here that I don't want to see in a Spider-Man story. Why is Aunt May like 20 years younger?
I don't know.
Like when Eric Larson drew her, she looked like she was 800 years old.
Because she was an old, very old lady.
Yeah.
She was in her 80s or something, because, you know, Peter Parker had grown up and gotten married. But then they Mephistered that all away.
Yes.
Which, believe me, I'm still not.
I know. That's also fucking retarded.
We're reading this because Venom's in it.
Yeah.
That's why I picked it. We've been following Flash Thompson. I sincerely hope he is not just, like, the whole legless thing was, like, what kind of, like, made me like the character. He's vulnerable without that symbiote. He needs the symbiote as much as the symbiote needs him. And now,
Why is the Superior Spider-Man dating a dwarf?
A little person? I don't know. I do not know. I mean, she's a solid enough character. She was in the last issue, too, which I read.
Yeah.
But I don't know why it's in. I don't understand. I guess it's because, like, I don't know, honestly. Dan Slott saw Game of Thrones and thought we needed a second.
That's honestly, that's how it feels, like a really weird bandwagon.
Like, oh, look, Tyrion, look, he's like the only respectable like character who's a little person. So let's make another one.
Yeah. It feels like really sort of planted, just very artificial. It doesn't make a bit of sense.
I mean, she's okay. She's not, I mean, he writes her well.
Yeah, I think so.
But I don't, like, it seems just to like introduce controversy for the sake of, like, I mean, that Aunt May is suddenly like a bigot and like is asking if her grandchildren are going to be little.
Old people are bigots.
Not all of them.
Most of them all. I would say a high 90%.
My grandmother was not a bigot at all.
That's, and good on her. I'm sure she was a wonderful
open-minded
person.
One of the most open-minded people I ever knew.
Yes.
And I just don't think of Aunt May like this. I don't think of her as, like, the racist grandma.
Well, it you can't really blame them for it. They grew up in a different time.
I understand that. And I'm not blaming I just don't think that's Aunt May. Like,
yeah. No, okay.
I wouldn't say it's like, I would say, it's not like I would go, oh, well, I don't think there's an old person out there that is like, there's plenty of old people like this. Most of them are. Just because they just are that way. But Aunt May seemed always like, you know, like a very good person. And who would now have more, like, sense than to ask the girl point blank if they're great. And first of all, they've only been dating a short amount of time. And then she asked them point blank what her grandchildren are going to look like at the dinner table.
Yeah.
Aunt May wouldn't do that.
If
she brought up the subject, she would do it respectfully in a different situation, I think, in my estimation.
It's all things like this that I really do think that it's storytelling intended for a younger audience. I think it's got to be a little ham-fisted this way.
I guess so. This, I can't, the one thing you cannot discredit this book for is its sales numbers, because it sells very well routinely.
I'm really curious. I mean, it would make a lot of sense, because they've made everyone in the new Spider-Man. It's the Spider-Man movie has gone a lot younger, and I wouldn't doubt that this just has probably majority, the overwhelming majority, are younger people that aren't reading any other comics.
I don't know.
Honestly, it'd be interesting to look into, because I am guessing, I'm blowing smoke, but it seems very plausible based on the way it's written. I think that it's not badly done. It's just not. It's clearly not for us.
No, it's definitely not for me. I don't know what to say about if it's a buy or don't buy.
I kind of want to keep reading it just because it's fascinating. Not necessarily good, but fascinating.
Yeah, as long as Venom's in this book, we will be reading it.
I'm fine with that. I'm really interested in seeing what they're going to do, so I can either be mad or just, I don't know, watch a train wreck happen in slow motion.
I think that's not an insignificant portion of the sales for this book either, are people who are fanboys who are just like, who hate it and still buy it.
Marvel will do that. They fucking troll their
Dan Slott is certainly a troll. He is a big troll. When people ask him, oh, will Peter Parker, real Peter Parker, ever be back? He goes, no, he's dead forever. And I just want to punch him in his fucking face. Don't lie to me like that, you fucking idiot.
No character in comics is ever fucking dead forever.
Uncle Ben is the only one.
Yeah, Uncle Ben is the only one. I think that's and they'll bring him back. They'll give him some tights and he'll be kicking some ass.
It used to be Bucky, but then they brought Bucky back and did an amazing job with it. So.
What the fuck? He was Bucky?
What? Winter Soldier was Bucky.
What are you talking about?
Bucky. Captain America's Bucky.
What? Why did you bring up Bucky?
Because they always used to say, only people who stay dead in comics is Bucky and Uncle Ben.
Oh, okay.
And then they brought
I thought
Bucky.
You were saying that Uncle Ben was Bucky, and I'm like, that's a weird fucking coincidence.
No. They used to say, the only people who will stay dead in comics is Bucky and Uncle Ben, and they brought Bucky back, and it was really great story. So, no, there's Uncle Ben's the only one who stayed dead and is dead and stayed dead.
To be fair, he was a wicked man and deserved it.
So, Superior Spider-Man 23. I don't know what to say. I don't like it, but we'll keep buying it. I certainly don't like it. It's well, the art, I mean, it's Humberto Ramos. He's a very kind of polarizing artist.
I think that he's improved a lot. I still don't particularly enjoy looking at his artwork.
Yeah, he is much better than he used to be. I remember buying a Venom story he did maybe a decade ago at this point, and this is a lot better than that stuff. But I'm still, and this whole book, it's done very competently. I don't like it, though. Because I don't like the whole premise. I've said it time and time again. I always like just regular old married Peter Parker. What was wrong with that?
I think it just didn't appeal to teenagers.
Whatever. Because everything else in Marvel does.
Mm-hmm.
I think Young Avengers is the only one. Young Avengers is...
Yeah, they don't really buy these books, though. Spider-Man has a name recognition. He's like Batman. He's like Superman. He's the name. He's the flagship property.
I know. But they actually had a... They launched a little isolated arc this week under the Amazing Spider-Man name. Like a flashback story as a regular Peter Parker. So there's a couple books out now that are just regular Peter Parker. The Marvel Knights story and that the Amazing Spider-Man flashback story. So we're both on Superior Spider-Man 23?
Well, you mean confused? Yes.
Yeah, we're confused.
I think that I want to keep reading it. I think if you've never, ever, ever read a Spider-Man comic in your life, Superior Spider-Man is for you. But
yeah,
if you ever had any love in your heart for Peter Parker, for love of God, don't buy this book. Why is Spider-Man 2099 in this book?
Because when at the end of, I can't even remember the name of the event anymore. The one, that big event that happened that we read like two issues of and then stopped.
I don't remember that.
Where Wolverine went back in time and killed himself, a past version of himself that was also time traveling.
No, I don't remember this.
Okay, whatever. At the end of that event, I can't. It's the, you know, the universes collided. It's when Angela came over.
I don't remember us reading that. I know about that event. We talked about it.
We didn't read it. I'm just saying it happened.
I believe you. I know.
At the same time it happened, Spider-Man 2099 also came over. And at the same time, Galactus went over into the Ultimate Universe and is probably destroying
it. I was going to say, I hope he's eating it.
No, it's going on right now, Cataclysm. So that's what everyone's theorizing. It's not over yet, but everyone's theorizing it's going to, like, Miles Morales will come over to, like, the proper Marvel Universe or something, and that's, everything else will be destroyed, because that's probably the only thing that's worth anything in the Ultimate Universe. But, okay, that's it for Weekly Floppies. We got some serious Spider-Man hate going on. That's some good hating.
This is kind of like that last book, it's kind of like on Mythbusters when they don't get any conclusive information.
Yes, exactly.
That's how that felt.
We'll revisit it.
Inconclusive.
We'll have another go at it. Now we're going to jump over to Nerd Boy Book Club. This week we are continuing on with our Sandman saga. This is we're in the midst of it. There's 10 volumes. We're on 5 and 6 this week. The first one is, they're not in order of their original release. The collections. They don't have the issues in direct orders, which confused the hell out of me at first. But in trade, volume 5 is A Game of You, which involves Barbara, a character we had encountered in the earlier storyline.
Book 2.
Yep.
She was a minor character.
And now she's a central character in this story, where I don't even know how to, her, like, her dream, basically her dreams as a child come back looking for her.
Not even as a child, she always had those dreams that you could, if you go back to book 2, the dreams, when it shows her dreams, it's these characters.
Okay. But then the Cuckoo is this mysterious figure who's that's evil taking control of her dream world, so she's trying to deal with it.
It's a weird, weird, weird book.
Yeah. What are your, you having read everything, Eric, where does this stand in, like, your rankings of all the stories?
This, when I was younger, was one of my least favorites, and I reread it expecting to enjoy it more, and I think for very different reasons, it is now my least favorite.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
What don't you like about it?
It's kind of a lot of things that I don't really care about. Like, I don't really have any real emotional attachment to most of the characters in this. I'm not terribly interested in a lot of them, particularly the dream characters.
Yeah.
It just feels kind of empty. You know what it makes me think of? Is it's like her dream is sort of exactly the same kind of story as The Dark Crystal.
Yeah.
Or something like that. It's almost exactly like a Jim Henson movie, you know? Except I hate The Dark Crystal. What are your feelings on that?
I don't like Dark Crystal, no.
I dislike it thoroughly. I like Labyrinth, though. Do you like Labyrinth?
No, I don't like Labyrinth.
You don't like Labyrinth? When did you see both of them? Were you older?
Yes.
I was in my 20s when I saw both of them, but I think Labyrinth is pretty good, but it's definitely kind of not an amazing movie.
I do not like the whole. I just can't buy into the worlds of them.
Mm-hmm.
I feel similar.
Yeah. Well, it's the same kind of thing.
I don't care about these people in the first place, and then you make it...
Yeah, we're kind of splitting our empathy between, like, these two different worlds. Like, mm-hmm. I think that the most interesting character in the whole book is the transsexual Wanda.
Yes. I agree with you. I was about to say the exact same thing.
She's easily... Because she's got real conflict.
Yes, and problems, and, like...
Yeah, I mean... Sure, I'm sure that everyone's been there with a terrible breakup and your life is kind of falling apart, but it's not really something interesting to read about. So I don't really... I'm not terribly interested in Barbie as a character. Her lesbian friends aren't really providing us anything interesting. They're just like this weird, like, semi-abusive lesbian couple that are just sort of there. I do really love Thessaly.
I enjoy Thessaly's character, but the problem is, like, you get too much information about the non-interesting characters.
Yes.
And not enough information about the interesting characters. Like,
mm-hmm.
there's, you're like, this enemy is the cuckoo.
Yeah.
The cuckoo, whatever you want to pronounce it.
Cuckoo.
Cuckoo.
I don't know. That's what I've always said.
Anyway.
Whatever.
And it's, like, I don't think it needed to be a mystery what if you had gotten more insight into her motivation throughout the story.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would have been more interesting. But you only get, like, kind of this weird, vague reasoning why she wants these things. You don't get it until the last, like, near the end. Like, why her motivation.
Yeah.
And up to that point, you're like, why is all this happening even?
You know, one of the things that even though I thoroughly dislike this book, and it is easily now my least favorite story in... I think all of the Sandman.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And this is everything that I've read. All of the Neil Gaiman Sandman.
Mm-hmm.
This is my least favorite story. One of the things that really fascinates me. I mean, he talks about, like, how this is one of his more polarizing stories.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that he talks about is how he tried to switch off between having a feminine and a masculine voice. A lot of the women I know that have read this story enjoyed it a great deal more than me.
It's interesting.
Yeah, and I think that I think that on that level it's interesting to look at. I mean, so many of the characters, almost all the characters are women. I can't relate with any of them. The one that I relate with was born male.
Yeah.
And then the other part of the story seems like it's based on, or at least sort of in a similar universe to, a movie that I also feel is got a fairly feminine voice, which I also can't relate to.
I understand that point of view, the perspective that, you know, maybe a female would enjoy this. I never thought of this as, like, a more female voice,
mm-hmm.
even if Neil Gaiman says it is. I never thought of it as that. I just felt it was clumsy.
Yeah.
And the fact that I did not feel for any of these characters until the last issue of this, when you find out that Wanda dies.
Yep.
And that issue is heartbreaking.
Yep.
And I don't... Everything else in this is just leaves me, it's okay. I was just kind of getting through it. I didn't feel a thing until I got to the last issue.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing much happens except that, I mean, it just, I didn't feel, like you said, I didn't feel for any, I don't know how the perspective changes the fact that I don't care about two rote character, the lesbian thing doesn't, it's just they're rote.
Well, I just think that I don't know for a fact, but I just find that it's interesting
yeah.
that this does split people, And readers of the Sandman, it splits them on the gender line.
Yeah. And I found some of the characters, I found Thessaly interesting, and she's a female. It's just, I don't know.
No, and I don't even think that's what it is. I think that Thessaly is a very shocking character. If I'm going to be an armchair philosopher on it, I would say that women would possibly be drawn to different kinds of storytelling, and that this might speak to some of them. I don't know that.
I don't either.
But I do think it's interesting that I have known in my own life women that enjoy this book as much as other Sandman books. That I to me, it is weird and meandering, and it doesn't work. But apparently, for some people, it works.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of interesting.
I would say read this book just because of the last issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is genuinely heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
And very touching. But
she does the Kunta Kinte.
Yeah, exactly. And it works for, and you feel deeply for the Wanda character, and
mm-hmm.
that section when she travels back to her hometown and sees her family, who are all Midwesterners are terrible.
Are they Midwesterners?
I thought that's what I got the feel of it. Maybe the Northeast or something.
I thought they were Southerners.
Were they?
Because it kind of bothered me.
Was there any kind of like Southern kind of dialect or anything like that? I didn't see it.
A little bit. I mean, they're all very religious and close-minded, and the women have big hair.
That's true.
And she says, you know, out here you expect twisters and hurricanes.
Well, that's when I think of that was like the twister is like the Midwest. I thought like Oklahoma or something, which I guess Oklahoma is technically the South. I don't know what you consider.
Mm.
But anyway, whatever region it is, they're not very nice people.
I don't know. The whole hyper religious thing made me think Bible Belt.
That's, well, yeah. But, I mean, it regardless of where it is, that is the most touching thing in this mm-hmm. story, and that is not the thing that is focused most upon in this story. That is kind of like an epilogue to the story.
I think this story could have been more interesting, like if the artwork was really like incredibly lush, you know? The whole like other world might have felt a lot more like a real story.
Mm-hmm.
If they had a lot of like incredibly competent artists really adding a lot to it.
Yeah.
But this is sort of the transition point where they start to get some better artists on the Sandman, but they're still using really clumsy people.
Yeah. I was about to say, like, the arts in this is just kind of standard.
I don't know that it's standard. It's just,
I mean, there's some really good stuff in it, and there's also some kind of just, you know,
It doesn't offend me as far as the, it's not like offensively bad, but it's got some naive drawing in it in some places. And this artist, did you notice, actually shows up in the second book, Fables and Reflections? The second book this term?
Which issue was it? Do you remember?
I think he does the first story. About the Emperor?
That would be the second story, then.
Well, the first one's like a prologue story.
Well, woman stealing.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to wrap up Game of You and jump to that one now, or do you have any more points
Game
to
of
add?
You, I think we've...
Yeah, we've said practically everything that we can. I think it's interesting that it's pretty much on my scale of which books are the best. It's still, it's at the bottom before it was near the bottom, but it's interesting. I dislike it for different reasons now. I think I was very transphobic when I read it before, and it just kind of sort of, I don't know. I think I've grown up a lot, and that doesn't bother me anymore.
That's what they say. I mean, every time you read a story, the story hasn't changed, but you've changed.
Yeah. Now I'd like it. It's still bad.
Yes, it's still not, but you like, it's bad for a different reason.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. It's not as like Like we've talked about the earlier stories, like they're not finding his, like, what he wanted to do with this series.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I think he does what he wants, but it's just this execution. Yeah,
it doesn't work.
The execution is poor.
Yeah. Although, I don't know, I would like to hear dissenting points of view.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'd love to hear a female perspective on the story. Someone who likes it a lot. And why.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love to hear that. Unfortunately, I think we're just too butch.
Yeah, probably.
To enjoy this ladylike storytelling.
The second volume is volume 6, which is Fables and Reflections, which is kind of like a mishmash.
It's a lot of short stories.
Yeah.
Although it does seem to, a lot of it revolves around a lot of very important plot points in the overall series. This one actually is the stories with Orpheus in particular.
Mm-hmm.
There's echoes of this throughout the whole rest of the series.
Right. So it's, this trade comes after volume 5, but it has issues in it that occur, that were released before all the issues in volume 5. There's 29, 30, and 31. Game of You occurs in 32 through 37. And then it picks up with 38, 39, 40. A special, an annual, basically, and issue 50 further ahead, strangely enough. I guess they just, it's kind of hard to collect a series like this when there's, like, you know, a traditional comic book arc is 5 issues. Like, they try and, you know, write for trades, so 5 or 6 issues. When he writes 3 issues that are kind of themed together, and then another 3, and then one that's by itself, you can't, it, how do you collect that in a way that makes sense? And this is how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
The first 3 issues, I guess we could, are kind of told, are all flashback issues. Like, you said the first one's kind of like a prologue almost.
That's really how I read it, is sort of a preamble to this book, because it even comes before the introduction. Interestingly enough, the art for this was done by Kent Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Kent Williams taught at my college for a semester
when I was
there. I didn't get to take his class, but many of my friends were in his painting class. The guy is... He's a little bit like Dave McKean, you know, that he's kind of a rock star talent illustrator, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people kind of wouldn't understand what he's doing in this comic, but it was really nice to come back and read this story again in particular.
Yeah, how do you feel about this collection? Do you think it...
This is one of my favorites.
Okay.
Like, even more so than before. A lot of the stuff thematically that's in this book, I really enjoy. I think this is one of the... For a bunch of stuff that's just sort of thrown together, this is one of my favorite collections. Even though there's not, like, a narrative overall. I enjoyed rereading this more than I enjoyed rereading Season of Mists.
Really?
Yeah. And I like Season of Mists. It's just, I feel like I've read it so many times. I've probably read it more than any single, I probably reread it more than any comic I've ever read.
Right.
And it could just be that, you know, every emotion that I've felt in reading it, I've just been over it and been over it and been over it. There's no sense in even rereading it at this point. But this one I haven't spent as much time with, and it was very nice to rediscover it. There's a lot of things that carried a lot more weight than they did before.
Yeah, in turn, there's a story about, you get, the whole, as a collection, you get kind of Orpheus's story.
Mm-hmm.
Who's Morpheus's son, with, Calliope, who we had encountered in a previous volume.
Volume 3.
Yep. And in between that, you get several, like, just little one-shot stories with Dream having a bargain with Despair, and a story about the Emperor of Rome. Was it Augustus?
The Emperor of the United States and the Emperor of Rome.
Exactly, back to back.
Mm-hmm. John Constantine's ancestor.
Right,
I
yes.
Thought, I really loved her story, set in the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's some of the strongest art, and I think in all of the Sandman series, I think it's a really great story. I think the French Revolution's pretty fascinating too. And
yeah.
The scene at the end where all the decapitated heads start singing.
Yes.
Holy shit, that's chilling. That's such an incredible story.
My only complaint about that story is the lettering used for her.
Oh, God, it's so hard to read. I know exactly what you're meaning when she's writing, like, her letters or whatever.
Yeah. It took me, you know, 5 minutes just interpreting, just slowly.
Yes.
Figuring what the hell she's actually saying.
There's way too much text set in that. It is pretty fascinating that you can see that it's clearly, for one, it's handwritten, and you can see where the ink blobs up and it gets thicker and thinner
mm-hmm.
as the pen and the quill is running out of ink.
Yes.
Which I think is a very subtle touch, but I'd rather be able to fucking read the typography.
Yeah. I appreciate the effort, but mm-hmm. I would like just to be able to read it without working.
Many of the other times I've read this, I would skip all that text. I literally would. I would just skip it and go to when I could read it again. And I missed out on some good stuff.
And then there's a hunt. The Hunt, a story about Marco Polo encountering this weird desert. And then finally, a Cain and Abel story.
I'm fond of all three of these. Particularly The Hunt. I don't know. It's a very weird story. But it makes me think of
it is.
Jim Henson's The Storyteller. Did you ever watch that? I have a soft spot in my heart for that show, and something about it just works.
It reminded me more of Princess Bride.
I get that. Almost. You know, the grandfather telling a story, the frame story of it.
Yeah, that's the only reason.
What did you think of the story of Octavius?
Octavius? Is that the...
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. I liked it a lot.
That's one of my favorites. Got it. One of my favorite short stories in the whole Sandman series. I really like it. It's a really great one. I've always thought that, Rome was such a fascinating time in history when, the Roman Empire...
Yes.
And the emperors, they were such characters. I think it's interesting that they show Livia in the beginning. Livia murdered so many people.
Really?
Yeah. Oh my God, she murdered so many people. Or I according to I think the diaries of Emperor Claudius. Mm-hmm. Who lived to see all these people die. There's a really great BBC series I have DVDs of called I, Claudius. We used to watch them in Latin class. But it's a fascinating time in history.
Well, I think it's so fascinating to us, especially, is because the American Empire is... Mm-hmm. I mean, its growth and is very... similar to Rome and its growth and domination of culture,
mm-hmm.
the world, and we are often we compare, armchair historians compare ourselves to the Roman Empire and the American Empire. The only thing my only problem with it, and not that it's not believable, because it's completely mm-hmm. believable, but the whole thing, you know, with Caesar and molesting him. As a teenager,
right.
Well, it just seems kind of like...
I don't even bat an eye at that, because that's just kind of what
I know, that's what I mean. Like, I understood it happened all the time, especially then. Like, that was not even... Yes. There was not even a a stigma attached to
it. Yeah, there was practically no stigma. I mean,
it's just the fact that, like, you're this whole story, like, why is, you know, what bothers him, and this is it. And it's just after, with the introduction of Dream and the thing, like, you never understand why he has to pretend, not why he can't be emperor for a day. You just find out, oh, he got abused as a child and it bothers him, rightfully so. I wanted more at the ending, I guess. It's believable. It works.
Mm-hmm.
I just wish they'd answered the mystery. You mean, does that character ever reappear? Or is that it?
What, yeah, the Emperor?
I assume there's no more of him.
Yeah. No. What do you think of Soft Places? I know Karen Berger always said this was one of her favorite stories.
The Marco Polo in the Desert.
The Marco Polo story.
Yeah, I enjoyed a lot. I like this. I like this and the kind of the Arabian Nights story in Ramadan. Mm-hmm. Whatever.
Oh Lord, yeah, that's the Craig the P. Craig.
Yeah,
Russell.
That's probably my favorite story of all these.
He is an amazing fucking artist. He is no effing joke.
I mean, this is the, I don't know, this is the first time of reading this, all these Sandmans that I went, wow, the art's, like, really, really good. Like, I was like, you know, wow. Like, all the other ones are like, yeah, it's good. It works. Sometimes it's muddled. This time I'm like, wow, that's really good. And
It was right about this point when they realized they needed to pay some artists.
Put some superstars on it?
Yeah. I mean, it was consistently, you know, one of their most critically acclaimed books and, you know, all these things. It was really ridiculous that they neglected it for as long as they did and had such weak artists.
Yeah, and the art is wonderful, but this story is very, very good, and actually it's kind of a subtle criticism of the Middle East and an explanation, right, of kind of its history. And it reminded me of when we read
you're thinking of Persepolis, I'm sure.
No, not Persepolis. Well, Persepolis and
Habibi,
both of those. It reminded me. It made me think of, like, this is like Habibi. This is what Habibi should be like. This is more accurate. This I think is more accurate and works as both a wonderful exploration of their myths, the Middle Eastern myths and stories, fables, while also like touching upon like the awful like reality of the region and especially its current day troubles. Of the, you know, fighting wars and terrorism and all the conflict. And it does it in one issue. And I think that it's, obviously it's not nearly as long as Habibi is, but its feel, I think, is what Habibi should have been. You know, like, this does it respectfully.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like it's sexualizing the culture and, you know, kind of glazing over the conflict. And it's not hitting you over the head with thousands of, you know, themes, and it's in an understated way. It you know, explores all these stories and fables we hear, you know, the only things that bleed over from Middle Eastern history. I'm just looking at it again. My God, the art is great.
He's no joke. This is the story that really made me, you know, fall in love with his art. I've been a huge fan ever since. But everything he does, it's all just like this. It's all glorious.
Yeah.
He's a hell of an artist. And you can really tell that they had to step up their game with the color long about this time.
Yeah.
They really had to work a little bit harder.
And you say that this Orpheus story, this is going to, all this stuff's going to come back.
The two Orpheus stories, well, yeah. these are the two most important stories in this book.
Because they're going to come back, you know.
Yeah. Everything else in here really you can just forget about. But these two Orpheus stories, it's important to know who Orpheus is and what's happened to him.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really great story. But it sets up a lot of things. The relationship with Morpheus and his son.
Yeah.
I don't want to say Morpheus and Orpheus. I know. But, well, there I did.
Morpheus and Orpheus. Morpheus and Orpheus.
Mo and O.
Yeah, I like that you finally get to see the lost brother. The lost endless, the endless we haven't met.
Yes.
That intrigues
one of the
me.
One of the interesting things about him, he's called Destruction.
Right.
But after he stops, he basically like Morpheus has the dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
He has his own realm, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
He just leaves it. He abandons it, and decides that it doesn't need him. And because he abandons it, he's no longer Destruction. He's still one of the Endless, technically, but he's abandoned his post, so they don't call him Destruction. They call him the Prodigal.
Right.
Which I always thought was interesting, that he sort of loses his identity when he walks away from his responsibilities.
And I really enjoyed the Orpheus story. Just not only from that, but his journey into hell and
mm-hmm.
all that. It's really good. Really interesting.
Orpheus is pretty fascinating that way, and it's interesting the sort of echoes of Morpheus's personality that are in him, and that he's kind of a drama queen the way Morpheus is.
Yeah, an unwillingness to bend.
Yeah, the unwillingness to bend definitely is that's a definite hallmark of who Morpheus is. And this is old school Morpheus. He's a total dick.
Yeah, exactly.
Like where he leaves his son's severed head sitting on the beach and just walks away and doesn't even look back.
Does not look back once.
That's exactly the way he was. And that's what's so fascinating about how he is in the sort of modern day Sandman.
Right.
You know, the 80s and 90s Sandman.
Yeah, of all the things you learn from this volume, from Fables and Reflections, and all these, because a lot of them are all, you know, flashback stories to the past, a lot of them are.
Yes.
And you see how Morpheus was, and that does inform a lot of what you see his changes in behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And it informs you on his character arc, how he's become, you know, more empathetic.
Yeah. It really is interesting because I think the old Morpheus, I would be terrified to meet him. And while he's, you know, just as terrifying and powerful, you could probably, like, talk to the new Morpheus and he wouldn't go out of his way to destroy you.
Yeah.
In a lot of sections in these old, the stories of him when he was younger, it's just, he's kind of terrifying. I know if I woke up and he came to tell me a story, it would scare the shit out of me.
Yeah, it's interesting how he looks, how all the Endless there looked, how they change appearances over the years, and how the era kind of informs their
mm-hmm.
outward appearance.
Right.
Now the kind of the almost idea of that what they would look like makes them what they look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Like it's not even necessarily their own construction. It's really it's interesting how in the Orpheus story, he talks to Death.
Yeah, and she
looks like she does
the Death that we know.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. I was curious about that, how that works. Like, cause
she seems to be the only one that's immune to it.
Okay.
She's just whatever the hell she wants to be. I to me, that almost feels like more of an inconsistency than
it just brings you back to, I remember the very first volume, you know, how Morpheus says, you know, when he finally gets out of prison, he says, "We experience time just like everyone else. It passes just as quickly for us as it does a normal,
or just as slowly,
just as slowly." Yes, as a mortal, you know, he's sitting there for 70 years.
Yes,
and you know, just sitting, almost a seemingly infinite amount of time for a normal person, they'd go crazy. And that statement, then you see him, Orpheus, appear in Death's house, and it looks like a modern-day apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And she looks like her modern-day self.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly she changes it. And it makes me... You say it's an inconsistency, not necessarily you think it's actually a... Are they trying to make a statement about her and her powers as death is not like Dream is, or like the other Endless, is that she's timeless? She seems like she doesn't exist in all time, in like all time and all places at the same time, or is it... That confuses me most about this.
It is very confusing, and to me it just feels like... And it feels like an inconsistency that where they just wanted to put the gag in of a Roman walking into this 80s girl's bedroom.
Yeah, that's what I was like. I'm like, it seems just like a cheap gag.
Yeah.
But even then, even when she is, you know, even after that, even when she changes everything, she still has a dress on that is not
appropriate. Yes, it's not terribly appropriate for the time.
So I don't, is that ever... Do you ever get any kind of callbacks to that? No,
it's completely glossed over.
Ugh, that bothers me.
I honestly want to say that it was just a throwaway gag. It doesn't make sense because they're traveling through time the same way.
Yeah, same way we do.
Yes.
They don't travel back and forth. They don't go, oh, I want to visit this time at, you know, whenever they want. They have to.
Yeah.
They can go different places, but it's always mm-hmm. the present.
I mean, I think theoretically they sort of exist in multiple places in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no reason, like, they couldn't be on Oa or whatever the hell the Green Lantern world is, mm-hmm. or, you know, fucking Krypton. You know, yeah. You could... Like, why is there never a Sandman story on Krypton? That would be kind of awesome, don't you think? Artfully done, that could be really
good.
That
overture isn't over yet, so we still have, you know, 12 years before Neil Gaiman decides to finish it. We may get a Krypton.
One issue every 2 years.
We may get a Krypton Sandman story before he dies.
We may.
Or, well, maybe he'll die soon, and then DC will go, well,
they'll do before Sandman.
Before Sandman, after Sandman, Sandman postscript, Sandman, Superman, Sandman. Team-up book.
Where, you know, there's an MMO that controls Morpheus.
Yes, everyone goes to sleep all at once.
Yes.
Has bad dreams. Gritty, grim, bad, awful dreams full of violence. And grimness.
Gritty grimness.
Gritty grimness.
I hope that's a new DC character.
Gritty grimness. That'd be a good character.
New from DC. Gritty grimness.
Fresh. New 52.
Oh, God.
Anything else you want to talk about, Sandman?
No. What was your overall impression?
I again, 5 was kind of weak, except for that last issue. 6, I enjoyed it. I mean, it didn't have any kind of, just because it's not a cohesive story, all of it. I mean, there's obviously lots of every little individual story has its ups and downs. The number 50, the Ramadan with the P. Craig Russell.
Yeah,
that is
it's a real gem. That's one of the few they've actually released it. I swear to God, I have like a trade of just that story somewhere.
Yeah, that's the highlight of it. But all the stories they're interesting. Some of them, you know, are more important for the overarching story of the Sandman than others. I'm interested to see where it goes
from here. You
always say that the last half is where they actually start.
Yeah, this is when it starts to kick into high gear. It's the next couple of books are some of my favorite material. It's very, very good.
So, what's the next would be 7 and 8, and 7 is what, Brief Lives,
mm-hmm.
and 8 is
World's End.
World's End. Okay. Next week, we will be doing 7 and 8. We're going back down the mountain. we climbed up to the peak, and now we're hitting 7-8, and then 9-10, and we'll finish off our salmon retrospective in a couple weeks. But next week, 7 and 8. So read along, and then you can let us know how you feel about all this stuff. Let us know.
Yes.
Absolutely. But with that, we are calling this episode. We're bringing it to a close.
Mm-hmm.
Until next week, at least.
We don't have any funny quizzes for you.
No funny quizzes. We can't overload you with funny quizzes. Then they don't become so funny. But that was episode 31. And we are the Handsome Boys Comics Hour. You can find us at handsomeboyscomicshour.com. Show notes will be there, plus every episode as it is released. You can also find links to a whole bunch of stuff there, including our email, which is handsomeboyscomics@gmail.com. Our Twitter, which is at HBCHour. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/handsomeboyscomicshour. Like us there. We appreciate that. Leave us comments. You can find us on Tumblr, handsomeboyscomicshour.tumblr.com. Anything else I'm forgetting, Derek?
In terms of the
iTunes, your
stuff.
iTunes. Find us on iTunes, Handsome Boys Comics Hour. Subscribe. Leave us reviews. Good reviews get us more listeners, and
We
love more listeners, all right? We want everyone.
We love old listeners, too.
That's true. We are not ageists in any way.
Yes.
Except Derek. He hates...
I'm apparently transphobic, as we've learned.
Well, only past Eric.
Yes.
So if time travel, ever gets introduced, then it might become a problem.
I will fight old Eric.
But until then, don't worry about it. Current Eric is fine.
I'm the only one that can defeat him. I'm like Batman.
Yes, only Batman can defeat past Batman.
It's true.
With their Kung Fu Tiger Strikes.
With Reverse Dragon Punch.
Reverse Dragon Punch. You can find me online at Twitter. I am Mixmaster Cheryl. That's MixmasterCereal. And I'm at Tumblr on the same name. Eric, mm-hmm. Where can they find you and your things online?
Well, they can come right here and look at my things. You can go to freewillunlimited.com to see my portfolio. I was wondering how long it's going to take you to laugh at that awful joke. Just warms my soul to hear you laugh. Portfolio, freewillunlimited.com. You can get a collection of many of the other things I get up to online at ericzgoodnight.com. And you can tweet at me. My Twitter name is Mr. Bad Example, MR Bad Example.
So there you go, folks. Come on, leave us comments, leave us reviews, email us, send us messages, send us suggestions. What do you agree with us? What do you disagree with us? Anything. We like to hear it.
Well, just for the sake of argument, I think that all of your mothers are dumb and ugly.
So
if you disagree, send me a tweet.
If you disagree with that, if you do agree with him, also send him a tweet saying that you agree that your mother is dumb and ugly.
Yep. Probably promiscuous too. She's kind of a hoe bag.
Are you going to let that stand, audience? Handsomeites, you're going to let Eric just deride your mother like that? You better stand up for yourself.
Yep. What can I say? I'm opinionated.
But anyway, until next time, have a good one.
Rock and roll. It's a bad idea. Oh, God. My fucking cousin's cooking squirrels again.